You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where if we trigger you, we really hope you don't tweet at us a bunch of times. I'd hate to have to, like, mute you or block you or temporarily delete the Twitter app. That would be momentarily inconvenient. Oh, no. I'm your host, Justin Emelzeski, and it says a lot when I'm at the point of not caring what people say on social media anymore. Think about that. Think about that. Remember that XKCD comic? Oh, somebody's wrong on the internet? That used to be me. Now, not so much. But we'll get into that later. We got a whole news story all about that. You already know that because you know what the name of the episode is. But first, why don't you tell a friend about the show? It's always, always helpful. I was bringing my friends. Joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Well, we've got a lot of dictionary word redefinition in the news this week. Two things I noticed. One, I posted on my Twitter because I just thought it was hilarious. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary has decided to update the definition of homosexuality to put a trigger warning on each definition, saying that it's sometimes offensive. So apparently homosexuals can be sometimes offensive. I thought it was really weird that we're trying to make a generic medical term into an offensive term. Kind of like, you know, like saying, you know, biological sex is real is offensive. Now saying homosexual. So the neutral use of the term homosexuality is still somewhat common, especially in technical and formal contexts. Outside of those contexts, however, the word can be seen as evoking negative stereotypes and outdated clinical understandings of homosexuality as a psychiatric condition. It is a little circular to use the offensive word in why it's offensive, but that's either here nor there. The more important one is, and Justin, I have a question first.
Isn't it a little offensive to call it a psychiatric condition inside the definition saying it's offensive?
This raises more questions than it answers, as they like to say in the real verse. But the more important one is the fall of Urban Dictionary. Urban Dictionary is going woke. Justin, did you read that Facebook post? It was a woker joke. I was like, this has to be a joke, but the more you read the Facebook post, the more you realize, no, it's not a joke. They're going woke. How can Urban Dictionary even function if they're going to ban quote unquote hate speech?
Yeah, I skimmed it when you sent it to me because Urban Dictionary has always been a joke, so it's not a surprise that
I mean the point of it is that it's a joke. Like that, right. Like I don't know. So, you know, it's always, comedy's the canary in the coal mine, right? What you're not allowed to say in comedy is often the leading indicator. And
this isn't a surprise, William, right? Because we've talked about how the redefinition of language is a power move. And if they can control how you can speak, if people can control how you can speak, they can control how you can think.
Yeah. Well, and there's another thing that's interesting because you have to document like language is part of like what it when you're documenting how language is being used, which is kind of the role of a dictionary. Language is used in offensive ways. I don't know how you would define a term that imagine looking up the N-word in the dictionary. How would you define it and not itself be hate speech and then have to ban it? You would just not know what the word means.
And when we're talking with extreme examples like, you know, the N-word, that's obvious. But when you start doing the stuff you're doing now where you put homosexuality, sometimes offensive, potentially offensive, you start getting into, with every word, offensive to who? Because you could words like weird or cute or nice, all of these words could be offensive to specific people as well. So you're entering into really dangerous territory.
I know, Justin. You're offended every time I call you cute. So,
Well, it's also from by who said it too, right? I mean, something could be inoffensive from one person and offensive from another person.
You know, for a while, people were changing offensive terms to trademark terms, at, like talking in code. I think that you might see a resurgence of that, you know, so like if you want to, you know, you know, call someone a bad word, you refer to them as Facebook, Twitter, and that's just another Twitter. Another Twitter doing what a Twitter does. This does nothing but migrate the language for the actual races.
Indeed. Let's bring in our guest host for the episode from Flyover Country, the co-host of the Batman versus Superman by the Minute podcast. Not that Stephen Colbert. Stephen Colbert.
Hi.
Wow, that was exciting. You got anything you want to share with us besides hey?
No, I mean you covered quite a bit. I actually I typically don't correct people, but since you made the joke about it, I do pronounce the T at the end of my name to help differentiate it, but that kind of ruins the joke. So I guess that works out well for you to introduce it that way. And then
I actually wondered about that because Dave the Film Junkie always introduced you as Stephen Colbert, and I'm like, wait, that's not it.
Yeah. He became popular like when I was in high school, and so there was like if anyone was going to say your full name for attendance or anything, that's like the peak in your life of people saying it. And so I got to the point where I was like, yeah, sure, I know what you're talking about. That's really all that matters.
Yeah, one time when I was in college, I went back to a bowling alley when I was on break. I went back to a bowling alley in my hometown, and I put in my name as Justin while I was waiting for a lane. And then the fucking guy, when he calls me to the counter, he's like, we have a lane for Justin Timberlake. And I'm like, what are you doing right now? Everybody literally stopped in the bowling alley and looked at me as I walked to the counter. I'm like, that's on that guy. That's not on me. But it's just like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's really weird because I get like two responses to my name. Actually, it's funny because the other day I was on, I usually don't bring it up, but someone on the phone, I was like with customer support for something, and they asked my name, and I thought that I was choppy or something when I told her what my name was, and so just for clarification, I was like spell just like the celebrity, and she goes, wait, who are you talking about? I don't know who that is. And then I like, had to go at a whole, and I was like, great. Like, I normally avoid it because, like, I hate, like, drawing attention to it. And then I'm like, found myself in the middle of this. Well, you see, you know what The Daily Show is? Like, how far back do I go on this? And, yeah. But, like I said, normally it's like, as long as I know you're talking to me, I don't care. But we do pronounce the T if it's left up to me.
Okay. Well, Stephen Colbert is with us, just to clarify. There you go.
And we'll be pronouncing the T in the news without Daniel T. Richard.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
You know, William, I was about to say, but you know who isn't with us? Daniel T. Richard. So let's head into the news. But you had to step on it. So where's the way to step on it, William, drop?
Way to step on it, Justin.
That was you, not me. Okay, so before we get started here in the news, just want to plug Patreon real quick. As always, patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/patreon. We've also set up a local page, which some of you had locals page, which some of you have switched over to. I assure you, it's not a weird dating app, but I'm gonna put a link on the midside. So it'll be themidside.com/locals. You can go there if you want to switch over, if you don't want to give to Patreon anymore, if you're worried we might be canceled. Just a little extra insurance in case, you know, whatever could possibly happen. To start this week, the first news story is a follow-up news story to everything that's been happening recently. A few weeks ago, we saw the band Lady Antebellum changed their name to Lady A, and then, of course, immediately it came out that there's been a blues singer who's been around for 30 years, she claims? I don't know. I've never heard of this woman before. And she goes by the name Lady A. And what makes this story even more absurd this week is the change in direction as to what happened. So they were trying to negotiate as far as how the usage of Lady A is going to work. I don't know how you really negotiate that when you have two different musical acts by the same name. That's going to fuck with all the algorithms. But they were trying to negotiate, and then all the negotiations broke down, and Lady Antebellum, Lady A, decided to sue Lady A, the blues singer. So I have a couple quotes here I want to read. One's from the band, and one is from Lady A, the blues singer, because I think it kind of shows how ridiculous everyone is in this story. And this story sort of, for me, encapsulates sort of everything that's going on. So I'm going to read these couple quotes, and then I'll throw it to you, William. The first quote is from Lady Antebellum. "Today we are sad to share that our sincere hope to join together with Anita White in unity and common purpose has ended. She and her team have demanded a $10 million payment. So reluctantly, we have come to the conclusion that we need to ask a court to affirm our name to continue to use the name Lady A, a trademark we have held for many years." Now here's the quote from Lady A, the blues singer, her statement. "I was quiet for 2 weeks because I was trying to believe that it was going to be okay and that they would realize that it would be easier to just change their name or pay me for my name. $5 million is nothing." Brief aside, I would love to live in a world where $5 million is nothing. Anyway, "and I'm actually worth more than that. Regardless of what they think. But here we go again with another white person trying to take something from a black person, even though they say they're trying to help. If you want to be an advocate or an ally, you help those who you're oppressing. And that might require you to give up something because I'm not going to be erased. William, can someone who's worth $5 million be erased because someone who's worth more than that didn't give her $10 million?
I don't think that's how that works. I don't think the amount... It reminds me of those people that... try to dismiss people on social media because they have more followers than them, right? Like, you only have 5 million followers, you know, and I have 10 million, so therefore you're nothing. But isn't it, I just think it's hilarious that the way they're, like, trying to, this is both, like, just a trademark dispute, right? But they're trying to couch it in social justice language, and it just becomes hilarious, right? Like, "We're sad to share our sincere hope to join together with Anita White." Why would she want to? Like, she's got her own career and her own music, a different genre, her own, you know, name that she's had for years. Like, why would she want to join forces with Lady Antebellum? But I guess she's supposed to because they're her white savior? I don't know. And then, like, asking for money is the reasonable thing to do if you're going to, you know, like you said, it is music, so, like, that's the same genre, or the same industry, but, you know, different genres, you can have similar names, or even the same name with different genres. It does get confusing, but you do have to work something like this out, but it's just funny that we have to couch this in altruistic social justice language in the press release, but it's just purely a technical trademark.
Just legally speaking, also, if what they say they had the trademark for many years, if that's true, then this is something that really should have been resolved prior to that. And any exchange of money would be an exchange for damages done, right? So if she's like, this is something that should just be able to be litigated in terms of, okay, who has first use rights and who is being hurt or benefited? Like, is the band formerly known as Lady Antebellum benefiting from using her name instead of their old name? And if so, then that is the amount that they would owe her. And it's weird that it's become anything outside of that discussion.
Well, right. And first use is the exact right term, because even if Lady Antebellum trademarked it, if she had first use, the blues singer, Anita, then it's hers legally, even if they trademarked it, because she can prove she had first use. So you're exactly right, Stephen. I find it incredibly hilarious that this has become all performative, as William is saying. It's just, this has all been done in the public sphere when none of this needed to be done in the public sphere at all.
Right. Well, and even on their part to begin negotiations with her to, I guess they demanded money, but the fact that they began negotiations on that amount, the second there was a dispute, it should have just gone straight to the court to decide, okay, who has first use and are there damages and what are they? And then it's the end of the story. So it's a weird, like, that they even started talking about an exchange of money in the first place, which I guess means maybe they were just trying to, essentially she was trying to sell what may have been her first use rights. It's, I don't know. And then it's, and then so as a result, this now feels like a, like she's turning to the social justice aspect as leverage in her negotiations, as opposed to like, just continuing the negotiations as she originally proposed them.
See, normally,
Liam, I think, go ahead.
I was going to say, normally I would be, I would, have more, I guess, sort of disdain for what, the jazz lady A is doing. But in this case, I'm kind of all for it. And the reason why is the whole reason Lady Antebellum changed their name was to sort of get ahead of this, right? Like to use this social justice as a media blitz for their band. As look, we're so woke, we're changing our name. And all that does is invite these kinds of parasitic behavior. So in a way, it's sort of justice to me to watch this unfold. I don't know. Is that twisted of me, Justin?
No, that's you. I didn't even have to ask my question to see if you would say what I thought you were going to say. No, you're exactly right. The problem here, a lot of conservatives on Twitter are calling out Lady Antebellum being like, oh, you're hypocrites, blah, blah, blah. The problem here isn't that they're going to court. As Stephen pointed out, this is the correct thing to do. They should have just gone to court from the beginning. The problem is they tried to bend the knee to the whole social justice thing to begin with, which invited this to them. I mean, that's what's going to happen, because Lady A is clearly just, Anita is trying to just take advantage of the situation, and she's trying to get $5 million for herself. She asked for 10 because in her statement, she said she wanted $5 million for herself and $5 million to give to social justice organizations, which you're exactly right, William. If you really believe in this stuff, as Lady Antebellum is claiming, wouldn't they just give the $10 million? Because wouldn't that be what they were doing? Wouldn't they be living in line with their principles? So the band really backed themselves into a corner, and it's hilarious. So I don't know. I kind of have the same statistic. This is, to me, this is a great example of witnessing the farce.
Yep. Get woke, go broke.
Another example of witnessing the farce that's very interesting to me this week is the restaurant Abdow's Big Boy is replacing its mascot. So for anyone who doesn't know what we're referring to when I talk about Abdow's Big Boy, if you've ever been driving around, you've taken a cross-country road trip or interstate, whatever road trip, if you ever see the statue of the boy, the giant statue of the boy holding a hamburger, that's always been the mascot for that restaurant, because apparently he's associated with that hamburger. Well, it looks like they've also always had a mascot named Dolly, they're claiming. I don't know the history of this restaurant. But that's kind of the question I want to throw to you, William, is they have Dolly, who apparently is associated with this chicken sandwich. And now, coincidentally, they're going to swap out the statues and possibly change the mascot for good. But isn't this just the same thing as the band, William? Because, yeah, they may be switching out the male for a female, but they're switching out for a blonde-haired, blue-eyed little girl. Aren't white women just as evil as white men nowadays?
I guess. Yeah, we've got to get rid of the evil statues. We've got to topple Big Boy. I have a question, though. Maybe some of our crack research team that's in the show channel now. Hey guys. There's different like branches of Big Boys, right? Like growing up, for me, it was always Elias's Big Boy. So I wonder if they're different, like franchisees or the way that it's set. But it's always the same statue, right? Like it's always the same Big Boy.
Right. That's a fair point. Steven, did you have a different name in front of your Big Boys restaurants growing up?
I'm not sure we had Big Boys here.
Oh,
the it looks familiar. Like I'm sure I saw it like on vacation, like driving.
Austin
like,
Powers. Vacation Austin stuff, Powers.
Or that maybe, but I couldn't tell you what they're famous for other than the mascot looks vaguely recognizable.
Yeah, so I think I wonder if this is just like you said, just taking opportunity of it. I mean, also, you know, beef's hard to come by right now with all this COVID. So maybe it's time to market the chicken sandwich and get out of the beef burger business.
Make themselves a Chick-fil-A alternative. That's probably the
Is the woman a person of color, though, Justin? That's the important thing.
Well, as I was going to say, she's not. She's a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl. And yeah, that as well, Stephen, that they are maybe trying to market themselves as the Popeyes or the... as you said, Chick-fil-A alternative. Isn't this just going to... I just think this is going to backfire in their face.
Yeah, you've got to realize that in this time of toppling all statues, coming to the public, especially for a business based on rural business, and you're going to topple the big boy statue, that might raise some eyebrows. Maybe that was part of the plan. Hopefully they considered it.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens with that. That's something to track moving forward. I just think it's interesting we're like sort of throwing out all our cultural iconography. And speaking of cultural iconography and things that are really important right now is TikTok. And apparently, the headline says, TikTok teens are going to war against the Trump campaign after Republicans call to ban the app. We made jokes about this last episode, how it's a Chinese data mining app. It runs in the background and steals your data. William's the info security guy, so he can talk about that a little bit in a second. But Trump actually took this head on and said, hey, I'm considering banning this app. So all these teens that are on the app, you know what they decided to do? They decided to spam the Apple Store with negative reviews of the Trump 2020 app. Oh no. I hope no one retaliates against us by giving us a lot of negative reviews. It's just, this whole story just sort of encapsulates sort of everything I see right now with the way this whole cancel culture and everything works. So here's a couple quotes from the article, and then I'll toss a couple questions out to both of you. Here's one. I don't believe Trump is trying to take TikTok away because of national security, but more to retaliate against activism on the app and all the videos about him that drag him through the mud, said Darius Jackson, an 18-year-old TikTok user in Champaign, Illinois, who asked his followers Wednesday to keep...
There are 18 and over people using TikTok?
You sent me the TikTok of that cop from the Pacific Northwest on TikTok.
I saw that on Twitter.
It was a TikTok video, though. A lot of people are taking TikTok videos off of TikTok and putting them on Twitter.
My wife is on TikTok like all day, but I only ever see TikTok videos when they're cross-posted to Twitter.
Next quote. This is the first year I'll be able to vote, and I think activism on TikTok is going to make a big difference, Jackson said. So there's two questions here. One, should TikTok be banned? Which I think is a really interesting question because, you know, coming from a libertarian perspective, don't ban anything. But if it's national security, is there a legitimate reason to get involved? And this is where we go to the info security, right? This is where your expertise is going to come in, William. And then the other thing is, and I think this is more Stephen's expertise, because I think this sort of, you had a controversial tweet about something like this in the Release the Snyder Cut movement, where you were like talking about how you need to do more than tweet. So let's throw the first question to William. Should TikTok be banned? Is this a legitimate national security issue? And what kind of precedent does that set?
Yeah,
space.
I think that's an interesting question. So we know that China, the blur between Chinese companies and the Chinese government is 100% blur on your filter there. The company, Tencent, you know, has to walk a fine line with their government, right? They're held hostage by their government in China, by the CCP. So, you know, you worry, okay, they're collecting data. Are they keeping the data in the countries they're supposed to? Are they following privacy laws? Those are all, like, valid concerns. I don't know if banning them is the right thing to do. That seems, like you said, it seems like you should just caveat emptor, right? You should buy or beware on those. The problem, I think, comes in with this. So TikTok, I'm not sure how the corporate structure works for TikTok, but, you know, you look at other ways to get around this, right? If, let's say, the TikTok violates some privacy law in the United States. What can the United States do? In a sense, they're backed up by the Chinese government. What can they do? Right. So that would be sort of the just trying to steel man the banning argument. Right. Like there's what do you do? Subpoena them for the records? Well, they're just going to lie. And there's nothing you can do about the lie because they're backed by the CCP. Right. So I can see why there's a concern here. I don't think banning it is the right answer. I think, you know, there's other ways to get around this. You know, if TikTok was a U.S. company owned by China, that would be different because then you have an actual entity that you can subpoena and you can pull records from. And there's things in the United States or other countries that actually follow the rule of law. But when you're dealing in, you know, when you're dealing in China, it's deuces wild, right? So if the data goes to China, it's gone, right? And I think that's where the security concern comes from.
So long story short, it comes back to personal responsibility again. There's nothing the U.S. government should do, but maybe think long and hard about using a Chinese app that steals data.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, you have to dig into, like, what is their privacy policy and how enforceable do you think that is by the U.S. government? Right.
Steven, what about these quotes from this 18-year-old user of TikTok about all this activism? Because to me, when I hear things about like TikTok-tivism, as the article stated, I kind of just laugh because I just think these videos are kind of just, they're just screaming into the abyss. Looks like we lost him. Okay, then. I'll just say that. I'll just continue with my point then. William, you can hear me, right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I sort of think it's screaming into the abyss. I think these kids are sort of delusional. I think you give these people a platform where it appears they have an audience and it appears that they're making a difference, and it makes them feel good emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when is the last time, like, I feel like every election cycle we hear how the children will vote and, you know, then my children, now that I'm 40, I can call all of you folks 18 to 35 children, you know, that the children will come out and vote in droves and that all this activism will lead to voting when we know the data is just not there, right? Like, I wonder how many of those activists they interviewed, TikTok-tivists, whatever you want to call them, actually voted in the primary. It's probably zero, right?
Yeah, and didn't we see this? Was it Elizabeth Warren this week or recently who said that we need to lower the voting age to 16? Did you see that?
I think we should lower the voting age to the unborn. Be allowed to vote.
Well, as Midsider Tom just said in the chat, activists use their great as long as they vote Democrat. Right. And isn't that what's really, really going on in this? Is this whole thing is just they're trying to get people who think emotionally. And this actually applies to the story that we're going to talk about in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. For me personally, I think there's sort of an explanation to all this that makes a lot of sense, and it was a blog post that I was sent this week, so we'll talk about it there. I just got a message from Colbert on Twitter. He said his internet died, so.
We will try to carry on. This is why why SpaceX Starlink is coming soon.
Yeah. So let's go on to the last story, which is perhaps our scariest story of the week here. If you remember during all of the riots and everything, there were the pictures that came out about the couple in St. Louis who were standing outside their neighborhood with guns. And apparently the St. Louis prosecutors have decided to go after this couple. So here's a quote from the article. St. Louis Circuit Attorney Kim Gardner, the city's prosecutor, said she would be investigating the matter. My office is currently working with the public and the police to investigate these events, she said on June 29th. Make no mistake, we will not tolerate the use of force against those exercising their First Amendment rights, and we will use the full power of Missouri law to hold people accountable. So they took the guns away from this couple. But what's so scary to me about this, William, is she says, we will not tolerate the use of force against those exercising their First Amendment rights, except by the government, as we take away your guns, which is your Second Amendment rights. This quote's just completely wrong, isn't it, William? It's the First Amendment does not protect it citizen to citizen. It protects government against citizen. And people have this misunderstanding that the Constitution protects you against everybody. No, the Constitution is a limit on the government, not everyone else. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And I'm also 100% right.
William, my degree from FU says you are 100% correct.
This is absurd. Maybe, when you look at the context of the situation, maybe brandishing the gun by the wife, I think it was done improperly. But even then, if you look at the context of the situation, they were threatening to burn down their house. And they were on private property, their private property. This is absolutely absurd. So unfortunately, this is something that'll have to get litigated. I wonder if this attorney is running for mayor or re-election or something. And isn't the dude is a lawyer, right? Like, this is not going to go well for the city. I can't imagine this going well for the city. Because I just imagine someone coming into my driveway with pitchforks in hand saying they're going to burn my house down. And I'm standing there with my rifle, and then I get my rifle taken away. Like, that is a huge amount of injustice. I don't know. Am I looking at this wrong?
This seems to me like the perfect metaphor for our entire society. What I've been saying for a while is, I think I was having this conversation with Midsider Conrad, is when I grew up, I was always told the person who retaliates is the one who gets caught. The initial instigator doesn't get caught. And I never understood why we let that happen. Never understood why we let that happen. That seems to be what's going on now. The instigator isn't the one in trouble. It's the one defending themselves. That's the trouble. That's going to get in trouble.
Yeah, it indicates a complete lack of understanding and a complete being taken in by this narrative, where you say that it's your First Amendment right to go threaten people on their own property. Or even enter their own property because, oh, I'm exercising my First Amendment rights, or speaking out against, or speaking out in favor of Black Lives Matter on your property, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense at all. That's not how.
Well, it's because they're starting from the premise of communal property. They don't believe in private property. And
it's way worse than that. They see it as everything is about privilege and power, right? And here's a powerful white couple. So, of course, they should bow, right? We can do anything. It's a deuce is wild for me because we're oppressed, and it's everything from you, including your life, right? We're going to burn down your house, right? Everything from you because I am oppressed. You are higher than me on the power profile. Therefore, I can do anything I want.
Right, exactly. And the fact that they're basically endorsing this, the government's endorsing this, the St. Louis government is endorsing this by taking away the people's guns. And this is a trick that I see all the time in all of these protest videos, and I it makes me fucking angry. It's out of everything I see, this is what makes me the angriest. There's a video now, it's like a 3-year-old video that I saw the other day, of a guy standing there saying, holding a sign that says, you know, I am against the suppression of speech. Or it said something like, you know, I am for allowing all viewpoints or something like that. And he was just standing there. And eventually so many people came up to him that they just started standing near him and moving slightly so that they were pushing him out of where he was standing. To me, that is assault. But their claim is going to be that it's not assault because they didn't hurt him or attack him. But it's, to me, and I'm going to use a football metaphor here, it's the same thing as pass interference. You have a right to the space that you're in. And if a defender comes in and tries to move you off that space, or if you're the defender and you have that space and the wide receiver tries to push you off that space, you have a right to that space, and that's a penalty. It's the same thing here. To respect other people's individual rights, it's assault if you physically in any way, no matter how innocuous you try to make it look, it's assault. And it pisses me off that these people think they're so smart and clever and that we're letting them get away with it, that they can do this thing where they can stand next to you and slightly move you. And if you fight back at all, if you push back at all, they claim you're assaulting them. It pisses me off so much.
Well, we can't have that, Justin.
Well, me getting pissed off or their behavior?
Both.
Do you understand what I'm saying about their behavior? I mean, do you see this happening in all of these videos?
Yeah, I do. I do. It's, I don't know. It's hard because it's subtle and sometimes effective, but I don't know. Part of me is like, I'd rather see that than, you know, bashing people's head in, which is the other thing they do.
What, that they do?
Yeah, that Antifa and BLM does, right? So, you know, if that had been a MAGA hat, it would have been violent, right?
Yeah, somebody in the chat just said, it's like the kids in the backseat putting their finger closer and closer to each other's face, that level of behavior. It's that, but a step worse, because they're actually making physical contact. And to your point, William, with that, I would rather them just hit people over the head. It's more honest. It is more honest.
Yeah, interesting.
Do you understand what I mean by it's more honest?
Yeah, yeah.
Just shows how inherently dishonest these people are. All right, so I think that sums up the news for the week. Just so people know, Steven is in the chat, but he's not responsive, so I don't know if maybe there's something wrong with his audio or something, but we're just going to soldier on into an interesting discussion in The Hopeful Romantic with JML. All right. So as always, you can join our Discord channel and get involved in the show. As you can hear this episode, we've got a lot of people in the chat reaching out and talking, and they're adding a lot of great content to the show. So if you want to join Discord, just go to themidside.com/podcast, click on any episode and click on the join link. And I just want to say thank you to all the people listening and participating this episode. What I would like to talk about in the art section this week, because we haven't had a lot of art talk over the past however many months, because one of the things they've tried to kill off is art, movies in specific, is this blog post that was sent to me by Midsider Katrina. It's for a website, thezman.com, thezman.com. Sometimes I read these posts. He is a pretty good cultural commentator. Usually he says things from a perspective I hadn't thought of, and it makes me think of things in a more pointed way or shifts my viewpoint. And this blog did exactly that. And I think it's a good way to look at things, because I think it answers a question that I bring up a lot. So this blog post is talking about the Black National Anthem and how the NFL wants to play that before games. We talked about that previously. Talks about Hamilton and how a specific population, specifically the more left population, the more blue tribe, if you're on Twitter, you see that, or blue team, as Don Watkins called it, tends to talk about how great Hamilton is. So before I go any deeper, have you seen Hamilton at all, William?
No, I have pretty low interest in watching it. I suppose because of its cultural influence, I should probably watch it at some point. I know it's on Disney Plus now. I don't know. It seems like a weird founding father to make a musical out of, but I don't know. I'm interested to see what this guy's take is on.
Yeah. So what you're talking about is exactly why this guy wrote a blog post on it. It's exactly why I watched Hamilton. So before we go much deeper into this analysis here, I'll just give a brief review of Hamilton. To answer your question, William, the reason they gave or they made a musical about Hamilton is as the I can't remember his fucking name. The guy who did Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Yeah.
As Miranda said, he is the most hip hop founding father. He actually was an immigrant from the Bahamas. And he's the one, Hamilton is the one who set up the National Bank under George Washington's administration. Now, I don't know a lot of his, you know, a lot of the economics behind it, and I'm not an economist.
Did he own slaves?
He also did not own slaves, and he was against slavery. So that was the other big
thing.
There
you go.
So if you watch this musical, what they do is they basically cast him as a big government social justice politician, which is insane because he wrote like 52 of the Federalist Papers. So you see the contradiction in what they're saying. But that's exactly the point that Z-Man brings up here. He's saying that all of this is performative. The Black National Anthem, he said the Black National Anthem's always been performative. It's always been propped up by white people, not by black people, to virtue signal, basically, to perform the cultural, prevailing cultural morality. And the same thing with Hamilton. He's saying it's performative. The love of it isn't because it's great. And Hamilton's not bad. There's a lot of creativity in it. Some of the directing is really interesting. They have a circular stage that rotates. That's really interesting. Some of the lyrics are pretty good. Some of the performances are pretty good. But there's not a lot of depth to it. It's a very long show, and it sort of like touches on the surface of everything. And he's talking about how the fervor over it, the excitement over it, is performative. It's showing their allegiance to the prevailing cultural morality. So here's a couple quotes here's a quote from the article. There's no shortage of analysis trying to explain the insane behavior of mobs pulling down statues. All of it from outside the progressive hive misses the point because it projects reason and consequences of thought onto the performers. I found this very, very interesting, that quote right there. The idea of projecting reason and consciousness of thought on the performers. Because we may even fall into that trap sometimes, William. What's happening is these people are just that, performers. They are unconsciously playing a role like participants in a pagan ceremony. They are doing so for their progressive audience who cheers and sobs after each statue is toppled. This is the real source of power of the left. It is not that they control the institutions or control the media. Those are consequences, not causes. Their real power is they control public morality and the expression of it. All public rituals are funneled through left-wing mythology, drawing in friends and foes, all of whom play a role in the great ongoing morality tale of liberal democracy. Like pre-Reformation Catholic Church, the left controls the supply of salvation. What do you think of this, William? I don't necessarily want to use the term left. I want to talk, you know, I think this is more in the mythology is controlled by social justice or communists, that kind of approach. What do you think?
It's a Marxist power ideology, but yeah.
That's the word.
I think this is spot on, and it really dovetails with what we've been saying, the last few seasons about how this social justice ideology is a religion. It has all of the cultural mechanisms and machinery for religion, and they're absolutely right. The power comes from the fact that all, even criticism of it, gets sucked into this social justice lens. And so how do you blow it up? You blow it up by pointing out that just because someone has more power than you doesn't mean they lose their identity, they lose their individuality, right? That we don't have to look at everything in terms of this power hierarchy, and that people are individuals. It comes back to individualism. There's no reason to assign me characteristics because you look at my skin and decide that I have privilege.
Well, right, exactly. And I even think the way you're speaking here now, though, applies more reason to them than they realize that they are, than they're actually actively doing. And it makes me think of something I talk about here all the time, and it makes me feel fortunate that we have Stephen with us today, because it makes me think of discussions I've had with you about Zack Snyder's works in Batman versus Superman in specific, where it's undeniable that there is an immigrant motif in Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman. It's undeniable that he dies, gives his life to protect Lois and to protect the world. But people work backwards because I think they're starting from this morality. And we see it with the way people approach analyzing movies.
People, I think, tend to latch on to, especially with art, I find that most of it is really just confirmation bias unless it's like explicit to what it means. And so whenever anything that happens that kind of leaves it, like leaves that door open for interpretation, instead of kind of seeking like what did the artist intend, people try to find more like how does this fit kind of what I want it to mean, which sometimes is interesting, but I find more often than not, like, you just find it's like all answers solve for the same thing in that case, which is kind of more boring to me than, you know, what was it supposed to say or how true is it.
Yeah, and boring is the perfect way to put it, I think, because you end up seeing all these takes over and over again that are repeated, or you end up in these inane conversations that you're just like, what's going on? Because people are trying to fit it into the confirmation bias, as you're saying. The most extreme one that I've had, because the immigration one, you can understand how they get there. But the most extreme one I had is somebody tried to claim that Zod was the individualist in Man of Steel and that Superman was the collectivist in Man of Steel. And they just kept blowing up my mentions over and over again, telling me how I didn't even understand anything. And it's just...
I mean, Krypton had its chance. Right? Isn't that, that's like the line.
Right.
And then he destroys the collectivist birth ship. So yeah, it's weird. With Hamilton specifically, it's really weird because I didn't see the musical ever, like until it was on Disney Plus, but I loved the music. I thought the music was all great. It was really interesting to me how whenever something like that happens, people like once again kind of fit it into their existing lens and very much focus on, like, speaking of the narrative. It focuses very much on Hamilton as was an immigrant, which, I mean, everyone was then, so I don't, it's an interesting fact, but it's been really weird how there's been very little, at least that I've seen, examination of his role in creating the central banking system and kind of how that's turned out. Of all like the analysis that's gone into that, that's kind of something the musical even almost praises him for. And I think that the overall result of that, you know, decision on society has, maybe controversial or debatable, to put it lightly.
Well, that's exactly. And that's, if you're going to have a musical about the founding fathers and you're going to honestly approach it and you're going to try and fit it into our current conversation, you would think that would be something they would have. And that was actually one of the most intriguing parts about the music is I liked how he recast the debates within Washington's cabinet as battle raps.
Mm-hmm.
But and I was reading his, because his annotations are on the Genius website. He said he was trying to make it more than a typical battle rap, where it was supposed to be more depth to it. But I don't think there was depth to the way that battle rap was approached. I don't think there was any sort of economic debate in it. I don't think there was any, you know, economic theory put forward in that conversation to show why Hamilton supported it, even though he wrote the Federalist Papers.
Right. Well, it didn't really reverse engineer everything. It kind of made the assumption of like America is great. And so we know the outcome is great. And so therefore we're going to examine how it got there. But then they skip all of the like how it happened stuff and just kind of talked about how it happened without examining it. Like they talk about being in the room when it happened, but don't talk about why or what specifically as much.
Right, exactly.
Which, yeah, it feels set to meet a predetermined outcome of, you know, whatever the narrative is that they're trying to set. I think the storytelling was really cool, and how they to look at it from cultural perspective, they took a very white medium of storytelling and fit it into a non-white narrative style, and culturally, how rap rose up versus the traditional American musical, and that's all cool and kind of gives you a new perspective on the story by telling it that way, but then it doesn't necessarily shed new light on what any of that actually means. It just tells the story in a different cultural format.
Right. And let's not forget, it's not the first one to do this, right? I mean, I don't remember what year it was, but remember Beyonce had that hip hopera when we were growing up? I don't remember what year that was in. So it's not the first either. But I think that's exactly what this blog post is talking about, where the response to it and even the creation of it itself is performative. So Miranda, and, you know, I see comparisons to certain filmmakers, and I'll make that comparison in a second. Miranda was able to find a way to create a performative piece, not in the sense that, you know, this is a musical performance, but he didn't actually create a lasting piece of art that, you know, that's, you know, thematically depth and comments on reality. He created something that structurally and on the surface, even down to the casting, right? There's a lot we can say here about, oh, is it really a big deal if you just swap the actors' races? Does that really matter? But we're living in a time where everyone's saying, oh, well, if you just, you know, make Ariel black, that's a big deal. Should that really be a big deal?
Well, I think in the context of this story, it does add an interesting kind of nuanced reframing of it, because it is, I mean, outside of the existing cultural, social justice debate, there is sort of an interesting question about, what if the story was happened this way, or what if the story was told through a this kind of oral tradition instead of the more white oral tradition. But like I said, I feel like it doesn't capitalize on that as much as it simply does kind of just does it.
Right. And that's the performative aspect of it. Right. And we see that, you know, the filmmaker I really see doing that is Jordan Peele. What do you think about that, William? Wouldn't you say that Jordan Peele's movies, when we talk about Get Out and Us, aren't they very performative in the same way, where it takes the trappings of these ideas? And then, you know, my biggest problem with Get Out has always been the final reveal, where it's like, okay, yeah, you set up this wonderful world and you set up this great commentary, and then the denouement, the execution of it at the end, is they're swapping their brains out.
Yeah, I guess I you know, I didn't watch the movie, so other than our review, that's my only contact. But is that bad that I've not watched an entire Jordan Peele anything? That's pretty interesting. I think that's why I have such a hard time watching things like that, because, like you said, there's a loss of the universalism in a way, by making it more performative. Like, I would contrast it with something like, you know, we talk about telling interesting stories that are universal, and having these, a play with, play on things like race and class. I have to bring it up. If you're playing the drinking game, I have to bring up The Expanse, right? That is not performative, right? That it is telling commentary on real, world sort of issues of discovery and risk and oppression, but without.
Yeah, I was gonna say there's definitely class, right? Battles within.
Yeah.
The Expanse.
And there's the idea of longstanding hatreds and collectivism, right? The whole disintegration of Mars is a huge storyline, and all this is done in a very universal and in many cases individualist way, right? And I think that's the contrast that you're really looking for there when you look at something like a performative piece like Hamilton versus, with all its historical baggage. I know it's easier in sci-fi to, we always talk about sci-fi being escapist, but in some ways it's easier to paint these universal things in a sci-fi universe, because you can play with more rules in a sci-fi.
Well, and I think that there's often, especially nowadays, a substitution of like subtext for like main themes. And so with something like Get Out, I thought Get Out was like a great thriller and I enjoyed it as a horror movie. And the things that people are talking about for its cultural relevance are all present in the subtext in some way. But I don't think it that's not necessarily what the movie, I don't know. I don't want to say it's not what it's about, because obviously it's all in there. But it feels almost like you take a movie like Alien and Alien's got tons of like phallic symbolism and sort of messages in the way that it's constructed, from the design of the aliens to the way the android works and all that kind of stuff. And the chest burster being born like from Ripley. But that's not what the movie is like about. That's just kind of the subtext that is added. And so I feel like if Alien had come out and everyone had talked, or like, I think Thor Ragnarok is a great example, how people say it's about like colonialization. It's like, well, no, it touches on that as like, maybe it's like a subtext that's in there, but nobody ever makes it like a main theme. And I don't really think it necessarily says anything about it. It's just kind of flavoring. And I think when you miss the difference, you kind of dilute the message itself by trying to make it bigger or more significant or claim credit for saying something that was never really actually said.
Well, right. And that's why I think when I talk about someone like Peele, I think he's doing that on purpose. I think he's leaving it like that. I think he's setting up these sketches essentially to do that. And Thor Ragnarok's another great example, because you talk about, and I'm never sure how to pronounce his name, but Waititi, is that how you say his name?
Yeah. Taika Waititi.
Waititi, yeah.
I've seen people get in big trouble for pronouncing it incorrectly, so be careful.
Well, that's why I prefaced it, that I don't know how to pronounce it. But he's a similar director as well, where you talk about a movie like Jojo Rabbit that was praised so much. It was praised not because of its technical execution, but because it was just capitalizing on the zeitgeist and letting people fill in the blanks. Jojo Rabbit, I liked the setup. I liked the idea of what they were doing. Hitler as an imaginary friend, to show how it influences the youth and the development. But then something I talked about was just the execution of the ending, where it showed that it didn't really have any real understanding of what its own theme was. The way the Hitler character, they got rid of it. The way they executed the ending as far as the relationship between the young boy and the Jewish girl, it all just sort of fell apart from a writing standpoint. And when I'm sitting there in the theater and I'm able to say like, oh, this could have been done slightly differently and it would have been so much better, that shows me that they're doing this performative morality of it. And Stephen, when you start talking about people filling in the blanks with subtext and everything, it immediately makes me think of, and this gives me a much better understanding of the reaction to Sucker Punch. Sucker Punch was one of these movies that was right down the middle, right? It's critiquing both sides. It's critiquing everyone, masculinity, femininity, and it's showing what's wrong and how to approach these things healthily. But people are trying to, when they watch it, they try and fit it into the surface level overall, whatever the accepted collectivist morality is, and they try to understand it from that point of view and they miss it.
Well, and I think we just talked about this conveniently on the last episode of Batman v Superman by the Minute, about how metaphor is not analogy. And I feel like that's kind of what we're talking about here, that you can include a theme or a metaphor for a concept in a movie without it being a straight one-to-one analogy. Like, you can say this is like this, but that doesn't mean it is that. Like, you can include a cross in a scene and you're referencing like some crucifixion mythology, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're saying this is equal to the crucifixion. And it seems like that's the mistake people make a lot with what we're talking about.
That's a great example of it, because, and I'm not going to name any names here, but there was a person a while ago that I used to have a lot of run-ins on Twitter with about Batman versus Superman for exactly that reason. There is no argument that Snyder uses a ton of Jesus imagery and Christian imagery in Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman. But that does not mean he is, as you're saying, saying Superman is analogous to Jesus. I think he's very intentionally saying there are ways he's similar and ways he's different. But, and this goes to show that, you know, the performative nature of the prevailing morality doesn't necessarily mean the society. It means whatever is the prevailing morality in somebody's soul and somebody's psychology, they'll approach a piece of art that way. If you look at the way this person approached it, this person always said, oh, well, no, it's the most Christian movie ever. It's the most Christian movie ever, because that was the prevailing morality in that person's mind. And seeing all the Jesus symbolism, especially, you know, the taking Jesus off the cross thing, they're making that comparison there, or Snyder was making that comparison there. They saw it in that way rather than taking a step back and seeing it as a metaphor rather than an analogy, as you put it. And I think that's a great way of putting it. I think that's a lot of what Z-Man's getting at here. And the scary thing, William, is Stephen pointed out very well how this happens in art. But the scary thing is people see the world in this way now.
Now or all the time?
Well, that's a broader question, right? Is this the way humanity has always been? Or is this a broad...
I think that is true. This is how humanity is. I think narratives, like, that's why, to bring it full circle back to the stuff we talked about in the news, that's why the destruction of our cultural symbols is important. Changing the narrative is important. The story we tell ourselves help anchor ourselves in the past so that we can deal with the present and face the future, right? And when you have these, when the stories that you tell yourself about yourself or your culture or your community are a certain way, that leads you to have certain values and or is derived, it's influenced by your values, and it changes your behavior going forward. And what is culture other than just a collection of behaviors, right? Individuals doing things. And so, yeah, I think it's always been that way. So that's why when we think about art and what you respond to it, it's okay if your personal response is this way, right? But you'll gain a deeper appreciation, a more universal understanding of yourself and the art if you approach it with this more objective approach, where you're thinking, okay, what is the art really saying, right? Like, what is internal to this piece? And what is it saying? Is this an analogy or a metaphor, right? Is this an allegory, or is this talking about a universal theme in a different way? That kind of depth and approach brings you not only more understanding but more enjoyment out of it, right? You get more more depth out of it and more fuel out of it. And what is the purpose of art other than to give us that spiritual fuel?
Right, and to take everything you say and take it even a step further back from a meta perspective, to me this goes back to education. And it goes back to when you read things in school, the first thing you were taught was not what does this say, it's what do you feel about this? And the focus becomes on your response to things, not what things actually are.
Yeah, I think what you feel is an important question, but as long as you're using it as, hey, what am I bringing to this piece that's maybe obscuring the truth of what it's trying to tell?
Right. And the other thing about that is not just what am I bringing to the piece, but when you're talking about self-understanding, William, like you were saying, it's also why am I having this reaction to this piece? When I watch something and I really like get upset by it or really disgust me, such as like Black Swan, right? This is the example I always bring up because it made me so sick to my stomach when I watched it. And when I watched it, it was undeniable how technically brilliant it was, right? You can't fault that movie from a technical standpoint. But watching it, it just made me sick to my stomach, literally made me sick to my stomach. And so I said, why am I upset by this? What is upsetting me? Is it something like you said, is it something I'm bringing? Is it something the movie's bringing? And that helped me understand myself better. And help me understand what kind of stories I enjoy and what kind of stories I don't enjoy. Because I can then go and enjoy, Aronofsky's The Wrestler, which is a similar story but doesn't have such a negative edge towards, the ability to produce. It wasn't saying that always striving for greatness is going to destroy you. It was just showing how, you know, this man who couldn't let go and move on with his life was destroying himself. So it still had that edge of Aronofsky, but it wasn't as, you know, as harsh as Black Swan. But by trying to understand the art as it is, I was able to understand myself better as well. And I think that's the important thing as well, is you stunt yourself. If you're only looking at it from whatever your prevailing morality is, and we see how most people nowadays share the same prevailing morality of collectivism, if you're only looking at it from one perspective and not trying to understand what the art itself is saying, well, then you're missing out on an opportunity for self-growth. It also hurts your ability to look at reality. And then things are complicated further when we have these pieces of art which are made from the same perspective, and then the artist will say, oh, well, you know, art's up to interpretation. Or other people say, oh, art's up to interpretation. So this becomes a self-reinforcing cycle where we just, it gets worse and worse, and we get more and more entrenched in this.
That's not depressing.
Well, let's do a final question here. I have a final question for you, Stephen. Have you had any pushback on any of the things you've said, or you and Andrew Dice have analyzed on Batman versus Superman by the Minute, because of this approach people have, where you may have pointed out like what, you know, Snyder was doing or what the writer Chris Terrio was doing, and people said, oh, well, that's not true, blah, blah, blah?
Not really yet. I think we had the benefit of, because of the nature of Batman v Superman, our initial audience was very much people who were already like fans of the movie and kind of willing to engage with it on the same level as us. So we didn't have that much of an uphill battle. I think that we may run into that. We also had the benefit of Snyder released his own commentary after we were about 40 or so episodes in. And we were very happy that basically he just said everything that we had already said about it. So kind of like affirming our approach. So we'll see, you know, what comes. We'll get into more controversial topics and people might disagree at that point. But we also don't necessarily cast a definitive answer to a lot of things. We find that Snyder likes to ask questions more than he likes to give answers. And sometimes the questions are more interesting than whatever answers you're going to give.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
It's a great point, because when you ask questions and people don't have this perspective that William just talked about and that I just want to do a little more detail on, people tend to provide their own answers rather than think about it. Rather than reflect on it.
Yeah. And if you hear him talk about his movies, it's very common that he'll use language. He'll say something like, I'm fascinated by the notion of depicting, you know, Superman with a hero, with a, you know, Christ symbolism or something along those lines. And that doesn't mean he thinks he's Christ. He just thinks that, like, drawing the comparison is an interesting contrast. Or, you know, and those are the specific words. Like, I'm really interested in the notion of whatever. Which never necessarily means he thinks that that's true or false or the best way or the worst way, just that he thinks it's an interesting intellectual exercise to look at it from that angle. And that's kind of the way that we approach it as well, that we think it's cool, but not necessarily that there's one, or not always at least, one specific way to take it.
Well, and that's what's so interesting about the movie, is the whole thing is really a meditation on what is it to look at Superman as a god and look at him as a savior.
Right.
And then people just take him as that. So it's interesting. All right. I think that's a good way to wrap things up. So let's end the episodes as we always end them. What did we learn this trip, Steven?
I learned that I can always count on my internet to cut out at the worst times.
William, what did you learn?
I learned that a statue of a young Dolly Parton will be erected in front of all the Bob's Big Boys to sell chicken. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
I wonder if that's true, if that's why they named her Dolly. I just think that Z-Man article is very impactful, and the idea of you're not always talking to someone directly, you're talking to whatever their prevailing morality is, and you're not really arguing necessarily about the specific thing you think you're talking to them about. You're talking to them about their morality more than you're talking to them about whatever the specific thing is. That's really interesting to me as a concept. All right, I want to say thanks to Steven for stopping by this episode, coming on. I think you added a lot, especially in the art section. Plug where people can find you. Anything you want to plug right now, where can they find your podcast, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at SM Colbert. I'm also a writer and editor at Screen Rant, so you can find my articles there sometimes. The BVS by the Minute, I co-host with Andrew Dice. You can find that in basically any podcast service. Just search BVS by the Minute or Batman v Superman by the Minute. And it's the same on Twitter. And we also just started Justice League by the Minute, which is going to be about Zack Snyder's Justice League, a.k.a. the Snyder Cut, when that comes out. But in the lead up, we'll probably just do some trailer coverage or something. So that's more of a future thing. But you can get subscribed and be ready for when that comes, though.
Did you do any episodes for that yet?
We did an episode zero that was like, hey, we exist and this is what we're going to be doing. We're planning on doing a breakdown of that first teaser, that even though we're kind of way behind on that. But yeah, right now it's just the episode zero is up.
Definitely check those shows out. I've enjoyed the episodes of BVS by the Minute that I've listened to. I listened to it when I was driving across the country when I moved from California to Florida. I'm really excited for when you get to the minute where he says, this is my world, you are my world, because that's such a big thing in the movie that so many people miss, especially because it refers back to the conversation with his dad on the mountaintop, where he asked his dad, you know, well, how did you silence the voices of, you know, everything you felt like you did wrong? And he talked about his mother and how his mother became his world. So it's just, it's so important and so many people miss it. So I'm really excited for that episode. As always, I want to thank everyone for listening to the episode, especially those people who joined in on Discord and participated. That was great to have you all in here. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. We always appreciate it. We have these discussions about individual liberty and freedom, so thank you for that. Patreon, as I said at the top of the show, we got Patreon, we got Locals. You can find that at midside.com/Patreon, midside.com/Locals. You help us keep the lights on, you know, give as much or as little as you want per episode. And as always, the most important thing you can do for this podcast is tell a friend. If you like the show, if you enjoyed it, tell a friend. And, you know, that's what we did with BVS by the Minute. I enjoy that. That's something that I think is high quality, and I'm telling you about it. So if you have same feelings about this show, tell a friend. This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelzneski, reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a riot. Case that made it to the recording, those were fireworks, not gunshots. Dog was letting me know.
No, I didn't hear those. I think I forgot to change the ending, though, because that Have a Riot's old, so we're going to have to change that to something else. My bad.